Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Nasiri, and each week, my goal is to help members of the armed forces and the military veteran community navigate their civilian career. Today is episode number 184 with Hector Rosecrans.
And it was a great job. I kind of got to see all the inner workings of the capital markets, how trades are processed and settled, the just sheer volumes of money that people are moving around the world. And we're talking, you know, in the trillions and trillions of dollars on an annual basis. And what really amazed me about this was that it was all run on next-day technology. And it blew me away to walk onto our trading floor and just see the MS-DOS terminals up on everyone's screens as we're, you know, as you have these high-end things on the front end of finance that really paper over a lot of this complexity. So I got the sense that there was probably some technical improvements that could happen here that the industry was ready for, and had heard about crypto, had heard about Bitcoin, had heard about blockchain, and it struck me that this might be a potential area where it could have an impact.
This is the second interview that I've done around blockchain, around cryptocurrency, around financial tech in general. If you haven't listened to episode number 177 with Stephanie Vaughn, that's a great place to start. Tons of reasons to listen to my interview with Hector. First of all, resources. He has so many resources he lists, and we really delve into more about how to understand this space. But what I admire about Hector is he actually learned how to program. He learned the basics of how to actually work on a technology level in this space. I left with resources that I'm going to look at, and I think he was great for that. If you are interested in blockchain, technology, operations, startups, we cover a lot obviously related to that. I left with a sense that veterans are very well suited for the blockchain space. He talks about how right now in this exploding space, very few people have more than 5 years of experience. And with the work ethic, discipline, operational excellence that most veterans have, you can play in this space. You can go directly to it. He talks about, one thing I found really interesting, he actually got his job through Twitter, and he talks about why blogs, Twitter, and podcasts are great sources of information and really areas to be investing more thoroughly in. And that's something else I took away from this, that I need to up my game in those areas. As always, at beyondtheuniform.io, you'll find show notes. There are a lot of resources in this show. If you're driving or running, don't worry about trying to keep track of them. Just go to the podcast section, find the show notes for this episode, and they'll all be hyperlinked there. If you're enjoying the show, the top three ways that you can help right now is, first of all, tell a friend. One thing I'm realizing, I realized this at the Service to School Summit recently, it's very, very difficult to get in front of members of the armed forces. And I'm struggling to find ways to really make inroads to those who could most benefit from this show. So one way you can help is by sharing this with your shipmates, squadron mates, squad mates, you know, platoon mates, whatever your deal is. Help get the word out with those who can benefit from the show. There are also options to donate on the website, as well as we have a new sponsorship program upcoming. If you know of a company that would like to advertise, please send them my way. So with that, let's dive in to my conversation with Hector. Joining me today in New York is Hector Rosecrans. Hector, welcome to Beyond the Uniform.
Hey, Justin, how's it going?
Good, good. I wanted to give listeners a quick background on Hector, and special thanks to Stephanie Vaughn from episode 177 for making the introduction. Hector is the Director of Policy and Operations at Messari, which is building an open data library to enhance transparency for the crypto asset industry. Prior to joining Messari, Hector worked at JP Morgan in capital markets operations and technology, where he researched tokenized securities for the broker, dealer, and custodian. He developed a proof of concept smart contract for asset management on an Ethereum-based enterprise platform. Hector served as a surface warfare officer in the U.S. Navy and has worldwide operational experience. He holds an MPP from UC Berkeley, where he studied cybersecurity and strategic deterrence, and a BS from the U.S. Naval Academy. So maybe to actually, before we dive into what you're doing at Messari, what is this proof of concept smart contract for asset management on an Ethereum-based enterprise platform? That was during your time at JP Morgan?
Yeah, that's while I was working at JP Morgan. And JP Morgan had a really interesting strategy for dealing with blockchain. They took a fork of the public Ethereum network and created a more secure, more private version of it that could be trusted by the banks and also have a lot higher throughput and a lot better technical performance than you can have on a big public network. So they had a hackathon, and I was starting to get into this stuff, and I'll get into my background and how I got there. But I know that I wanted to build something for this platform. And I had this idea that what you could do is you could use these smart contracts in addition to our traditional capital markets infrastructure to create portfolios for people that were a lot more flexible and a lot more liquid than your traditional mutual funds and even ETF type structure. The idea there was that you could enable anybody in the world who was properly vetted to be a capital manager. They could publish the recommended portfolio allocations to this platform, and then anyone could then pay a small fee and subscribe to it. So basically the idea was to take, you know, the hedge fund model, the mutual fund model, or even the ETF model, whatever kind of investing style you wanted to use, but really make it flexible and allow anyone to access it from a supplier standpoint. So the idea was to allow anyone to become a portfolio manager and to get paid relative to basically their skill and their ability to convince people that they were able to do this. And the way I saw it was going to be a little bit similar to, you know, what the internet has done for podcasts, for blogs, to really kind of democratize the supply side of the industry. There ended up being a million technical and regulatory hurdles that got in the way of actually executing this, but it was a ton of fun to build. It was a ton of fun to kind of think through what this could look like. And ultimately, part of the reason why I moved on from JP Morgan was I just felt that it was going to be a bigger challenge to kind of use this infrastructure for the legacy asset class than it would be to use this infrastructure for the emerging crypto asset class.
And how did you? Well, let me start. There's so many questions I have. So I'm assuming that at the Naval Academy you studied was it computer science?
Not even close. I studied oceanography. I was I loved the math that I got into there. That was actually a really helpful part of it. I was very comfortable with some of the, with things like differential equations and thermodynamics. But I've always thought that I wanted to study things that are applicable to the work that I'm doing. And I was really excited about oceanography, having the sense that I was probably going to go into submarines or surface warfare, that, you know, this stuff is directly applicable to how sonar works, to how currents work, to a lot of the kind of physical environment that we operated in. But I was lucky in that it had a broad enough skill set and a lot of applicable physics and math that I felt like I had a pretty good grounding in some of those technical subjects that then allowed me to kind of pick up some of this computer science and economics down the road later in my career.
And so when did you get into programming then? Because it's pretty impressive that that you were joining this hackathon and it sounds like you were coding.
So I should say that I am not a professional developer. I'm on the business side primarily, a little bit on the investing side. But as I was getting into blockchain, as I was realizing that this was a really exciting field that I wanted to understand, I basically taught myself a bit of Python. I never thought that I was going to be a full-time crypto coder, contributor to things like the Ethereum open source repository, the Bitcoin Core repository. The people that do that are brilliant and incredibly talented. But I took the view that I needed to understand enough of this that I could be literate in it. I could read basically and maybe write rudimentary things here and there. But I approached learning software development from the perspective of, I need to understand this stuff at a technical level. I need to significant degree of technical literacy. So I got into just going into GitHub pages, trying to follow the instructions, trying to download the software. On the quorum page, when I was prepping for the hackathon, there was this thing that said, hey, you can get this lightweight version of a client up and running in about 10 minutes. And I spent the better part of a weekend, much to my wife's frustration, trying to get everything that was supposed to happen in 10 minutes up and running. That 10 minutes was predicated on you having a bunch of other pieces kind of already running in the background. But the great thing about the internet, the great thing about software development is that all the tools for anyone to learn this stuff is right there. It's most of it is free. You know, you can pay a little bit extra to have a slightly more curated experience on something like Code Academy or Coursera. But all this information in how to learn software development, how to think about this stuff is just free and open and out there. And so I kind of went down the path of learning a bit of Python, primarily through Code Academy. And that's how I got to the place where I was at least dangerous enough to kind of put together a pretty rudimentary product in some of these things.
And I just want to make sure, and for listeners, I'll have this in the show notes at beyondtheuniform.io. But it sounds like if you were recommending to someone maybe who's on active duty who wants to start to get their feet wet in coding, it sounds like the resources you mentioned were primarily Code Academy, but also Coursera, GitHub, and Quorum. Are those was it Quora or Quorum?
No, Quorum is different. Quorum is JP Morgan's enterprise blockchain version of Ethereum.
Okay, gotcha.
That was just something that I was playing around with specifically for the hackathon. Code Academy has really been the one my go-to for getting into this stuff. Code Combat is also one that's pretty fun. And I can look through my notes because there's a few other resources that I don't have at the top of mind right now that are kind of fun. There's these little video games that are all based on scripting in Python and JavaScript that are a ton of fun to play around with and a really easy way to get your feet wet in this stuff. But I find that just diving into it is definitely the way to go, and all the resources are there. I wish I had known that I wanted to do this back when I had some time towards the end of my active duty career. I'd be so much further ahead of where I am right now.
What I love about this, or maybe what I'm projecting on this, is I feel like when I was on submarines, my functional knowledge of different areas of the boat either allowed me to be a better leader or restricted my ability to be a leader. So if I didn't really understand the way the machinery operated, I was inhibited in my ability to lead the auxiliary division. And what I like about what I'm hearing from you is you, I'm guessing you had a sense you wanted to go in this direction, and so you wanted to at least understand the mechanics of how this worked. You wanted to have that fundamental knowledge, you know, not extensively deep, but have some hands-on experience of what goes on behind the scenes. And I really respect that, because I think that takes, you know, you already said it took weekends, it took nights, it took time out of your existing schedule. But I'm guessing that allowed you to connect with your team in a deeper way and also understand the direction the technology is going in a more fundamental way.
Absolutely. And I love that you're a former OXO as well. That was my first job as a SWO, and I absolutely loved just knowing nothing and figuring out how I could add value to my guys and to my team, and also leaning on them for that technical side so I could understand how an HVAC unit works, so I could understand how a diesel engine works, how the HPUs work. And I take the same approach here. When I got into the technical side of it, the immediate reason was because I felt like there was a lot of debates going on that I couldn't really participate in, and that these conversations absolutely were what were going to drive the quality of an investment in crypto down the road. So there's that aspect to it. But I also knew that I wanted to be more involved actually in building products and building services, and at least having that kind of basic understanding of what a developer goes through and how they kind of structure their work and how they think about it. I knew that I wanted to have that so I would, you know enough to at least be a little bit dangerous in my conversations with my tech team that I'm definitely having on a regular basis in my new role.
How did you even get into blockchain? I'm assuming that was while you were at JP Morgan, you started to learn about this new technology and its applications?
Yeah, absolutely. So my background was I decided to get into finance after grad school, which was a big transition from doing a master's in public policy to basically going the totally opposite direction towards the world of finance. And I can connect the dots there a little bit, but it was definitely tough when I first decided to get in. My first job, I did some stuff that was a little bit, had a kind of tangential connection to governance. I was working at a small research firm that covered corporate governance issues. There's a lot of activist type investors who look for struggling companies that are poorly managed, and they like to go in and shake things up in the board. So our mission was to try to figure out what was driving those problems at the board. It was a great company. It was a great idea. That said, it was a small startup company and it did not last very long. And one thing I will say to anybody who's interested in getting into tech and especially startups is that you have to be prepared for things to go south and have a pretty solid backup plan. So my backup plan was to go to one of the veteran integration programs at a major bank. And I knew some people at JP Morgan, so I started getting involved over there and ended up working in their operations department. And it was a great job. I kind of got to see all the inner workings of the capital markets, how trades are processed and settled, the just sheer volumes of money that people are moving around the world. And we're talking, you know, in the trillions and trillions of dollars on an annual basis. And what really amazed me about this was that it was all run on 90 days technology. And it blew me away to walk onto our trading floor and just see the MS-DOS terminals up on everyone's screens as you have these high-end things on the front end of finance that really paper over a lot of this complexity. So I got the sense that there was probably some technical improvements that could happen here that the industry was ready for, and had heard about crypto, had heard about Bitcoin, had heard about blockchain, and it struck me that this might be a potential area where it could have an impact. So one of the great things about JP Morgan's veterans program is that they will find a way to get you an interview with almost anyone in the bank. Like, probably not Jamie Dimon, but anyone junior to him, they'll find a way to get you 15 minutes. And you have a lot of these conversations. I found that this was the case while I was transitioning. You do a lot of conversations with people in jobs that are interesting, that, you know, and they're very polite to you. They're very nice. But you can sometimes feel like they're not that interested. And what I've realized is that you're not necessarily adding that much value to them, but they're trying to be nice about it. So as I'm exploring this blockchain thing, I get 15 minutes with Amber Balde, who's the head of blockchain at JP Morgan. And I walk in there and I was expecting to have another one of those kind of like, hey, nice to meet you, whatever meetings with someone from the bank. And they're fairly predictable. And I walk in there and she has purple hair and tattoos and is wearing a punk rock t-shirt. And I'm like,
yes.
Who is this person? And she gives me this look like, what the expletive are you doing in my office? Not in the way of like, I don't want to talk to you, but in the way I have a million things to do. Why did someone at JP Morgan tell me that I should spend 15 minutes with you? And I remember next to nothing about that conversation, except the takeaways were she was incredibly passionate about the potential for the technology. She was incredibly passionate about open source and the potential impact of that in the financial sector. So that was my takeaway from her, but then also just the fact that she was there, the fact that someone like her who has this obviously very different persona, very different objectives from everyone else in the bank, the fact that she's talking about open source software and, you know, the impact of Bitcoin on how things are going to work in finance in the future. What it really told me was that someone very senior in the bank was taking this stuff very seriously, because you don't just get to be someone like that as an executive director at JP Morgan without a very good reason or someone very high up kind of making that happen. So that's kind of what tipped me off that there was something to this whole thing. And at that point, I just started kind of going down the rabbit hole. And a lot of people in crypto will explain this. I spent a lot of time first on Reddit, kind of getting into some of these communities, seeing what people were talking about. From there, they'll direct you to, you know, there's a bunch of different blogs out there. Bitcoin white paper, I ended up reading.
Do any of these stand out, actually? Because I was going to ask you about resources, because, you know, we could spend the entire episode just talking about what blockchain is and what all this is. But it, you know, you said Reddit. I'm just kind of curious. I'll list the resources in the show notes. But if you know, as you take us through your journey, what are the ones that you would point people to if they're wanting to better understand what this technology is, how it works, the potential impacts? Where would you point them?
So the first thing that I'll say on that is I like blogs more than I like books, because blogs, people can kind of evolve their thinking over time, and they can, you know, you can kind of have these core ideas and then reflect on them in real time and how different things that are happening can impact that, can be a demonstration of a particular concept or a, you know, or a counterfactual to it, and how writers kind of compare that, I think can be really valuable. Same thing with podcasts, and I'm also a huge fan of Twitter. So the particular blogs that I would recommend is, first, I think it's important to have a kind of good understanding of what's going on, broadly speaking, in the tech industry. And Ben Thompson's blog, Stratechery, is just hands down like the best piece of resource that anyone who's interested in tech, from blockchain to Google and Facebook and Amazon, all the way through, I think that is one of the best resources out there for anyone who's just interested broadly in like the dynamics that are shaping the tech industry. And there's a few posts that I can recommend specifically that are kind of his seminal thinking around this. But you know, I think that this guy is basically the intellectual successor to Clayton Christensen, who wrote The Innovator's Dilemma. And he, because he blogs instead of having a book, you can watch his thinking evolve. You can watch how he kind of reacts to different moves in the market on a daily and weekly basis. In addition to that, I really like Venkatesh Rao's Breaking Smart and Ribbon Farm blogs. I got into Venkatesh Rao because he had this fantastic long write-up on how The Office was an expose of how corporate politics work. And if you're a fan of The Office, and it's well worth the read, it's hilarious. But then he also spent some time working for the venture capital firm Andreessen Horowitz, and wrote this big kind of mini book called Breaking Smart. And I would definitely recommend that as well. And then on the crypto side, the podcasts are really kind of how I kind of initially got into things. So the Tim Ferriss Show with Naval Ravikant and Nick Szabo is excellent. Nick Szabo is possibly the guy that invented Bitcoin. No one really knows who invented it, but he's one of the leading candidates. And Naval Ravikant is a leading venture capitalist. He's the guy that runs AngelList. He's the guy that runs Product Hunt, and he's definitely a thought leader in the space. I also really like the Hash Power series by Patrick O'Shaughnessy. It's a sub podcast on the Invest Like the Best podcast, and there's kind of three initial episodes on Hash Power that are a great intro to the topic. And again, I mentioned Andreessen Horowitz. They have a podcast, and any of their podcasts that talk about crypto, particularly the ones that have people like Chris Dixon on and Fred Ersham, those are great resources as well as kind of initial things to start to wrap your head around the impact of this. There's a bunch of like crypto specific podcasts, but I think that those are better once you kind of already understand the big picture of things. And so that's why I tend to recommend individual episodes of these bigger podcasts rather than, oh yeah, go listen to Laura Shin's Unchained. She's fantastic. She's great, but I think you kind of need a little bit of the 101 before a lot of what she's talking about is going to make sense.
This is great. And, Let's talk about the work you're doing now. So how would you explain, first, you know, if someone's on active duty, how would you explain what Messari does? And then how would you explain your current role, which I believe is Director of Policy and Operations?
Yeah, so I think that to understand Messari, it helps to press the I believe button first on crypto, because what we're doing doesn't make any sense if you're not kind of already down the road a little ways there. So if you press the I believe button and say, yes, crypto assets like Bitcoin, Ethereum, all these ICOs are a real asset class, then the next issue that comes up is, okay, these are an asset class, but there's not a lot of good investor resources out there. There's a ton of information. All these projects are open source, at least all the good ones are, but there's no place where these are aggregated. And so there's a lot of money to be made for these research services that will go out and read a bunch of white papers and provide recommendations and do a lot of this analysis. But our view is that for the industry to really grow, you have to take the basic information, the basic financial information, and make it publicly available. The way that this works in the traditional markets is that the SEC goes to companies and says, hey, when you're going to file an IPO, when you're going to list a stock or a bond, you have to provide certain disclosures to investors. And I think that crypto needs something like that. The challenge is that a lot of the laws that are on the books right now don't totally make sense for this new asset class. In addition to that, if any one jurisdiction pushes too hard on disclosures or on trying to shut things down, these are digitally native assets. They can move overseas. They can move to Malta, to Singapore, to Hong Kong. And you really run the risk of driving a lot of this innovation out of the U.S. So what we think is the solution is to create an open source data library similar to Wikipedia, where we can aggregate all this information. And there's a bunch of different ways in which we incentivize people to commit to it. There's a bunch of different ways that we incentivize people to audit it and check it and verify it. If you're interested in that, I would highly recommend people go read the white paper that we published on Messari.io. But that's like a 301 level discussion to get into how those actual mechanics work. But basically, we want to provide tools for investors who are interested in the asset class to get involved and at least get the most basic information from which they can build up their opinion on any particular asset in the space.
And how big is the team? And then kind of what is your, could you translate your title to like what you actually do?
Sure. So I was I'm director of operations and policy. I would say that I'm probably 90-10 operations to policy right now. I was the first employee, so really just getting the company off the ground, getting our systems up and running, and doing a lot of the early hiring is primarily what my day-to-day looks like right now. But I do everything from accounting to IT management. Like I said, a lot of the HR stuff. Payroll management. I try to keep all the administrative tasks off my boss, off of our CEO's desk, and just keep the company running. I think it's a great job. It's a great initial job for people with like a military background, especially if you're used to kind of operating, without a ton of guidance. It's a little bit of a message to Garcia type problem at a startup, which I really enjoy. And if you like that, I think that startups can be a great way to go. If you like the military because you like being a part of really big organizations, then I definitely would not recommend going this route. But if you're kind of into the chaos, into decentralization, into how to manage that chaos, I think it can be a great way to go. And you also mentioned I mentioned that there's a policy aspect to it as well. Obviously, we're trying to do investor protection, we're trying to do transparency, and so communicating that to policymakers, to regulators is a key part of the mission. And we definitely have a lot of conversations with the people on the regulatory side that are thinking about this. We don't think that we're competitive with them. We don't think that we are, ever going to replace the function that they do or that they should ignore anyone that's listed in our database. But we do think that we can be a resource for them as a place to start and also as a place to show which projects are being more transparent than others.
Could you take us through, I know that no day is typical, but if you could abstract out a typical day, could you timestamp and take us through the type of tactical things that you're doing or activities that you're going, and particularly trying to figure out when you start your day, when you end your day, and what weekends look like?
Yeah, sure. So I work on a fairly normal schedule. I try to get into the office, somewhere between 8 and 9. I spend my first half hour or so planning out my day. And the way that we operate is the mornings tend to be kind of quiet time. So that tends to be time where you sit down and you're working on the specific projects that you have to deliver. So for instance, for me, that could be, I need to put together a list of all the metrics that everyone is trying to hit for Q2. So I'll be tracking all that stuff down and kind of aggregating it for a meeting, or I'll be working on a deck that's going to go to investors or to, regulators or to just the general public. So that's kind of the whole morning. I tend to block it out into hour and a half long chunks, kind of start to get more social around lunchtime. We'll have a couple meetings, schedule phone calls, and my afternoon tends to be focused on phone calls and meetings, either internal or external. I try to have a dedicated hour or so of time where I just sit down and grind through email and all the kind of like low-level administrative tasks that I know I need to get done, but that will kind of take me out of my focus if I try to sprinkle them throughout the day. And then, you know, meetings in the afternoons can be everything from, all right, our lawyers are going to come over to discuss what the next steps are for raising capital or a corporate structure or employee equity. That's one that we have coming up today. You know, we'll also sometimes just get the whole team together and brainstorm, all right, we need to design this particular feature of our technical stack. Let's talk about what should go into it, how we should think about it, and we'll kind of bat ideas back and forth. And one of the great things about our company and the size of it is that everyone participates in those conversations. Everyone has enough knowledge to contribute productively to that type of work. You know, when it comes time to sit down and actually build it, then we can get a bit more focused, and then that's mostly the tech team kind of actually scoping it out. But when we're in the, you know, product ideation phase and thinking through what these things are going to look like, that's all hands on deck kind of discussions. I usually head home around 6 or so, and I'm home shortly after that. I live pretty close to the office, which is nice. And then in the evenings, I will sometimes catch up on email. I spend a lot of time just doing reading, doing kind of deep dives into some of the projects that we're looking at, or catching up on what the conversation has been throughout the day on different social media platforms, Twitter, Telegram, Medium are primarily the ones that I focus on. So, you know, kind of after I put the kids to bed and dinner with the wife, I try to have another hour or two of just kind of quiet time. Again, either emails or doing a little bit of a deep dive into something that I saw during the day that I didn't have time to get into.
That's great. I love that level of detail. And one of the things, so let me preface the next two questions by when I'm listening to you speaking, and you know, a number of my friends have gone into this space. There are times where it feels like, and I say this amidst the backdrop of all of the hype around AI and drones and all, you know, you just kind of, I've been in tech for over 10 years now. You just see these trends come, everyone gets excited and moves on. Blockchain to me feels different in that it feels like the same sense that people must have had when the internet first came out. And it's like, oh, this is a fundamental game changer. This unlocks a lot of possibilities. And so some of my questions are geared towards that person who may be on active duty, who's trying to evaluate, is this what they want to try to go into? And so the first question in that line of thinking is, your path was Masters of Public Policy to Finance to Blockchain. And I'm curious if you were maybe on active duty right now, were those steps a good foundation? Would you recommend someone going straight into this, or what's a nice way to fill in some knowledge gaps between active duty and actually jumping into this?
So that's a great question. The public policy degree is kind of funny for me, because I find that the knowledge that I gained in the 2 years that I spent at Berkeley, you know, statistical analysis, political analysis, law, and then a lot of the stuff that I did kind of on my own research around game theory, around cybersecurity, are massively applicable to this space, and, you know, kind of marry up a lot of those ideas together. And I think that it's, in terms of the education that I got, I think it was like almost a perfect fit for this industry. That said, it did not help me remotely in getting into it. I did not actually study those things with the intent of going into crypto. I studied them because I thought they were interesting. I studied them because I was interested in kind of policy and defense policy and those kinds of things. And so what I would say about the MPP is that, you know, and about any grad school really, is that it's important to evaluate more so than the actual content of what you're going to get from the degree, what that degree is going to signal to people on the outside, what kind of network it's going to have. And I think that I didn't put enough emphasis on those pieces of my graduate degree, and was just very excited about, oh, wow, I'm going to go to Berkeley and learn all this really cool stuff. So it was definitely a tougher transition after grad school for me for that reason, because what I didn't realize is that even though Berkeley is the number one ranked public policy school in the country, And, you know, it's above like places like the Harvard Kennedy School or the Princeton Woodrow Wilson School. Those schools are much bigger and have much stronger networks in some of the areas that I'm more interested in. So I would say that if you're not sure about grad school, a great thing to do is to work for a little while and figure out what are the signals I want to send, what are the networks I want to be a part of. And that's at least as important, possibly more important for like a professional master's degree than the actual knowledge that you gained. That said, I think that it helps a lot to have some kind of background in economics or in finance or in computer science or in tech or something to kind of get yourself into crypto. It helps to have a little bit of a hook. I actually think that the military is a very good, like kind of gives you a lot of foundation for this stuff. And I wouldn't tell anybody not to jump straight into it, but I would just say, if you're, you know, anyone who's gonna do well will ignore any advice that I give and say, I'm gonna jump straight into this. This is 100% the future. If you're a little bit less certain about it, what I would recommend is go work in finance, go work in tech, go work for a big company that's gonna kind of expose you to the space and what people are talking about and what the trends are, and pursue this stuff in your spare time. Think about it, read, start writing. Definitely get on Twitter because that's one of the best resources out there to connect with people. And spend your time doing that. And then when you're like, okay, 100%, this is the way I want to go. And now I've worked at Microsoft for a couple of years, or IBM, or JP Morgan, or you know, some well-established company. I can see why working here is not going to get me to the place that I want to be in terms of working on emerging technology. So that's kind of the advice that I would give. If you're sure, go for it. If you're a little bit unsure, go to a big company first, then make that transition. And don't go to grad school unless you're really sure that's the right call.
I love it, man. And I love the statement you had, which is like the people who are really going to do this are probably going to ignore your advice anyways. That's my sense, is that this is a bit of the Wild West right now. And people are, you know, that's in some sense, I feel like this is an industry in which, actually, I'd love your thoughts on this. And I know we've only got a couple minutes left here, but there is part of me that feels like veterans could have an unfair advantage here. They are, in my opinion, very adept at working in ambiguous situations, executing, getting shit done. And so in that sense, because this is an emerging industry, the playing field is leveled. It doesn't really matter if they've had a tremendous amount of business experience because it's being invented as they go. That's one part of me. On the other hand, some of the smartest people that I know are in this space, and they have been learning about it for years, and they have such a bigger, broader understanding that in some sense, I worry that you know, veterans could be, you know, going straight from the military could be out of their league because they're playing so much catch up. And I don't know if you have a strong sense one way or the other, or just any thoughts on that, those two perspectives.
Yeah, so I think that veterans are definitely at an advantage compared to everyone else. First of all, because no one has more than 10 years of experience in that. Very few people have more than 5 years of experience in this. So that means that, you know, if you get into this now, 10 years down the road, you're going to have, you know, 2/3 of the experience of almost everyone else who's like super senior and like running these giant companies that are involved in this. And there's no other industry that's like that right now. So that's one thing for veterans. I also think that the community is very mission oriented, which is great. I think that there's a lot of overlap if you get into kind of the philosophy behind this, if you get into the implications of like strong cryptography that have a real kind of mission focus to them. And you know, frankly, and I'm trying to write a blog post about this that I'll get around to one of these days, that there's like some core kind of constitutional values, like American values, that this technology is actually enabling in a way that you haven't really seen since like the early days of the internet and the opening up of communications. And I think that you know, people that have served and kind of committed to a mission can definitely be attracted to the right projects in this space. But yeah, that said, there's definitely people that have been doing it for a while. I think that there was a while where you needed to have like a certain degree of, you know, a certain degree of expertise to get into it, because there just weren't that many jobs for people that were, you know, just starting out. But I think that's shifted actually in the past like 6 to 9 months or so. there's a ton of capital. There's a ton of people working. There's a ton of people working in the space. Even though, you know, there's a big setback in the price since the high in early January, it's pretty typical for the sector. And the difference between this setback and a lot of the other ones is that everyone is still building. Everyone is still heads down, focused on their product, focused on their service, focused on the aspect of the broader ecosystem. So there's definitely opportunities to get out there at a fairly junior level. And I think that you're right that it's absolutely kind of there for the taking right now. But you have to, you know, be willing to take on some pretty significant risk, and that's kind of true of any startup. But I think it's particularly true in this industry, as there's not a clear path for anything or anybody to get from, you know, point A to point B.
That's great. When you get around to writing that blog post, definitely send it to me, and I'll send as an update to our listeners. I'm just appreciating the way in which you're explaining this space, and I haven't heard it put that way, but I can see ways in which this technology is aligned with American values. I think that's like a very interesting perspective for it. So definitely send that my way. I know we're at the end of our time, so I just want to make space. I've asked a lot of questions. You've answered them, but I'm sure there's things I haven't asked. And just wanted to turn it over to you. Any final words, anything we did not cover? It could be related to blockchain or just careers in general, but anything else you'd want to share with listeners?
Yeah, so the one thing that I don't think I harped on quite enough is that when I got this job, I got my job through Twitter. I literally was following some people in the space, and one of the, you know, particularly following people in New York, crypto Twitter. And one thing that I did is I turned on tweet notifications for anyone who I was like remotely interested in getting hired by. And so what this allowed me to do is this allowed me to kind of see their thinking in real time, and also then just jump on Twitter and respond to them. I had enough knowledge in the space at that point when I was trying to make the transition from JP Morgan that I felt like I had something to contribute. I think that Twitter is this incredible resource in all sectors, but particularly in this kind of digitally native sector of blockchain and crypto. It's just where the best conversations are happening. You can see, you know, luminaries, people that are the creators of these protocols, arguing with CEOs of giant companies, like in real time, and the interaction is fantastic. And if you have something to say, you can jump in, and like it's the first time that, you know, that someone with some real stature, like, you know, likes or retweets you is a great feeling. You're like, hey, I actually know what I'm talking about. And I think that the dynamics of how that social network operates makes it a much stronger platform for like high quality networking than something like LinkedIn will ever be. LinkedIn I see as a necessary evil, but if you can, you know, start to engage with people and ideas on Twitter, you're going to be way ahead of the game.
That's fantastic. I haven't heard that put that way, but I think that's such a great point that I mean, I like what you said earlier about blogs and how it does feel like books, especially as it relates to blockchain, it's just they can't keep pace with the current trend of things. And, you know, people are able to mold their thoughts on podcasts and blogs in a way that's not true in books. It feels like that with Twitter as well. It is that dialogue. And that's insane. I haven't actually heard of someone who got their job through Twitter, but what a strong endorsement for the power of that. So Hector, thank you so much for taking the time to connect with us. If listeners are interested in kind of following you and keeping up with you, what's a good way for them to keep pace with what you're doing?
They should absolutely follow me on Twitter. It's at Hector Rosecrans, and I'll give you the link for that to make sure you get the spelling. And check us out at Messari.io. We have a newsletter service that we put out. That's how my boss kind of got into this. He's been writing and been on Twitter for a while. So those are kind of the two best ways to keep in touch. And happy to talk to anyone that's interested in learning more about the space and getting involved.
Surface. Thank you so much for listening. Just a quick recap. I really loved that sense, you know, that I got that this is a community that's very mission oriented, that startups are mission oriented, and that might appeal to many veterans. I still love that sense that, you know, if you're really interested in this space, you're probably not going to follow the advice that Hector was going through here. I think he has a lot of tremendous advice, but I think that the gumption it might take to succeed in this space is the person who's willing to just dive in and figure it out. And so that I hope that if that's you, that you'll be able to use these resources we mentioned and the advice we mentioned as a springboard, but know that you're going to have to figure a fair amount of this out on your own. I do have two more interviews in this space coming up. Stay tuned for those. And if you have feedback, especially because I've not yet recorded those other interviews, if you have feedback on the types of questions that would benefit you, let me know. Justin@beyondtheuniform.io. You can respond to the newsletter. You can use the contact us forum on the website. It's under ping. All of those go directly to me. So let me know and I'll try to incorporate them in the next interview. Have a fantastic week, and I'll be back next week with more of interviews with military veterans about their civilian career. Take care.